Welcome to the Innovation Nation on Career Buzz, Canada's unique radio conversation that empowers lives, enriches careers, and energizes organizations. Welcome to the Innovation Nation on Career Buzz. Hi, I'm Stephen Armstrong, and I'm pleased to be your host today on Innovation Nation on Career Buzz. Innovation Nation explores the intersection of the real-world business practice and people's career development. We explore how individuals turn their personal passion for innovation into tangible commercial success. Thank you for tuning in this morning. Well, today on your show, we focus on rebooting higher education in an artificial intelligence-dominated world. In the past 5 years, there has been a plethora of articles and critiques that higher education is not fit for purpose. By higher education, we mean college and university. They include the CBC, the Harvard Business Review, Forbes, NBC in the US, Times Higher Education, The Atlantic Magazine, Brookings Institution, and many, many more. Just Google those particular entities and put in higher education is in failure mode, and you'll have lots of articles. In the past year, AI has taken off like a rocket, disrupting every sector of society, including higher education. That's another one you can Google, and you'll find lots of articles. Today's guest is a true artificial intelligence pioneer who changed his career 15 years ago to address this problem head on, to fundamentally transform higher education. Today's guest is Professor Dr. David Goldberg. David is an artificial intelligence pioneer, professional engineer, entrepreneur, educator, and a trained leadership coach. A three-time civil engineering graduate of the University of Michigan, he taught engineering at Michigan, Alabama, and Illinois for 27 years, and as an academic was known for his work in artificial intelligence, particularly genetic and evolutionary algorithms, amassing an H index of 110. That means 110 publications with over 110 citations, including 6 authored texts, a number of edited volumes, and highly cited 108,000, over 108,000 citations. In 2010, Dave resigned his professorship and tenure at the University of Illinois to go out into the world to help transform higher education as a result of success of the iFoundry initiative at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Since then, Dave has headed www.3joy.com, a coaching and management of change leadership firm for higher education. He has adopted successful consulting methods from the private sector, applying them to the problems of higher education on 6 continents. And I have to tell you, listeners, that I had to cut back his bio significantly, but there's a lot more to it than just what I said. But in the interest of time, I just had to cut it back. David, welcome to the Innovation Nation.
Hey, Stephen, we've been talking about getting together on the radio for some time, and I'm really happy that the day is finally here. And thank you for cutting the bio so we could have some time left for your listeners.
Well, you can explain it all as the show unfolds. You can sort of fill in all the gaps. There's a lot of things I left out. Let's set the stage for the listeners, and we'll talk about your personal passions. What drives you to engage in such a diverse career? You know, you're a highly acclaimed academic. You give it up. I mean, who gives up the tenure in these prestigious universities and starts out in an entrepreneurial venture and to actually transform the industry or the sector that you came from? What keeps you ticking? Why did you do this? Or why are you involved in such diversity?
Yeah, well, my colleagues ask me that question all the time. They think that they still think that I was nuts to do that back in 2010 when I left the University of Illinois. But it was a natural progression. One thing kind of in my whole career, I never started out to be all the things that you said in the introduction. I never started out to be an acclaimed anything. I went to school to be an engineer, a civil engineer, and I was a civil engineer. I worked in practice in hydraulics and fluid mechanics, and I thought I was going to do that, and I thought getting a PhD wasn't cost effective until one day a professor asked me, "Well, Dave, when are you going back to get your PhD?" And I gave him the marginal cost of a PhD exceeds the marginal benefit. And I finally heard myself saying that. And I said, no, I want to go back and get a PhD. I love learning. And so I think learning is the theme that keeps me ticking. And then I didn't start out to do artificial intelligence until I did. I bumped into one of the founders of evolutionary computation as part of my studies after the official artificial intelligence class was canceled. I ended up having to take a course called Introduction to Adaptive Systems by a man named John Holland. Well, nobody knew. I didn't know that he had started this whole thing about using genetics and evolution to evolve solutions to problems. So that ended up being my dissertation. So I would just say, like so many careers, and I was listening to how you introduced to the show. So I'm betting that that's a common thing that so many of your people you've had on the show ended up following a passion, and they did what they did because it was interesting to them, and it grabbed them by the shoulders and said, "You've got to do this." And for me, a lot of the driving force has been interesting ideas, and so that's what I think that's what keeps me ticking.
Hermione, you actually worked as a civil engineer in industry. Is that correct?
You bet. I did for. I left school with my master's, and I was sort of a specialist in hydraulic transients. And so I worked at a little company, and it was one guy and a secretary in a cornfield in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And we serviced big water distribution networks, gas distribution networks. We did analyses of pump and valve shutdowns on circulating water systems and power plants. And I did that for about 4 years until I got the call to go back and get my PhD.
Now, when you were doing that, did you think you would have an academic career? Was the PhD just for learning purposes? Or did you know you were going to have an academic career? Or did that happen as a result of your PhD?
No. Well, so I went to get the PhD because my boss had a PhD, Mike Stoner, graduated from civil engineering in hydraulics and was also a specialist in hydraulic transients. And he'd built this cool little company. And I said, "Ooh, this is cool. This is the royal road to being an entrepreneur." And this was 1976. So in 1976, I go do this. And I thought, and I always wanted to be a tech entrepreneur. But when I left school, I said, I have some interesting things here. Genetic algorithms really aren't ripe. And so I ended up working a temp job at Ford Motor, fixing some old legacy Fortran code for a year. And I said, this isn't much fun. And so I applied for assistant professor's jobs. And I took my first position in the Department of Engineering Mechanics down at the University of Alabama. We're up to about 1984 or so when I I transitioned from my PhD to my first teaching job.
But you still had the entrepreneurial spirit. You saw it in those early days, but you didn't follow it until many years later, but it was in you.
Well, and that was such a cool first job because, okay, so the first day on the job, I walk in and Mike says, hands me four manuals to our, we had four computer, Fortran computer codes to analyze pipelines, steady state and transient, liquid and gas. And he says, oh, there's a customer in Harrisburg and they need your help. And oh, by the way, you need to go talk. At that point in time, this was before the cloud, that people had computer programs on time sharing systems. And so our codes were up on a time sharing system on IBM 370s and with a nice operating system. And they said, you need to go support our customers with the salesman at the CSS office in Chicago. So it was like this baptism by fire. I'm handed these things. I have to get on the phone and do customer service. I thought I was going to be programming these codes, but I'm customer service. I was training. I was sales. And so that job was actually gave me the entrepreneurial bug in a big way.
So then how many, I think you were 27 years as a professional academic, a career academic in the university. Is that roughly 27 years? Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah.
And then, okay, so we won't go into the details of your academic work at this time, but let's talk about your big move 15 years ago. And I'm sure it's hard to believe it's 15 years since you left University of Illinois, you give it up. What was the trigger? What was this, you wanted to transform higher education. That was your mission. How did that come about?
Yeah, so it's one of these things where I bump into an idea or a possibility. You know, it's like Huckleberry Finn going down the Mississippi. So it's Huckleberry Finn is a picaresque novel. It's from one darn thing to the next. So the one darn thing that triggered all that, there were a couple of darn things. One of the darn things that happened is in 2000, six, I revised a book called Life Skills and Leadership for Engineers, and then I renamed it The Entrepreneurial Engineer. So that book came out, and I put out a blog. And one day in the blog, I tweeted, why isn't there a philosophy of engineering like there's a philosophy of science? Well, that doesn't sound related to your question, but it was related big time. And actually, all of the things that have kind of happened since leaving the university are related to that tweet and the response. So I get a response from a guy in the UK says, "Oh well, the Institution of Civil Engineers in the UK is interested in that. And did you know that your own a National Academy of Engineering has a committee on philosophy of engineering?" I said, "No, I don't know that." He said, "Go look it up." I go look it up. I know some of the guys, so. One thing leads to another, and I end up as a co-chairman of a workshop on philosophy and engineering right around that time. The other thing that happens is I go talk to a buddy of mine at U of I. He says, look, there's this interest in philosophy. Should we do that here at Illinois? And he says, no, that's too narrow. Let's call it engineering and technology studies at Illinois. So we started a group where we got engineers, people in art, history, philosophy, and engineering, science, history of science. We got a bunch of people together and we started talking about these things. And one thing led to another, and it was, well, how do we do something with this? Which led to the creation of the Illinois Foundry for Innovation in Engineering Education. But even that wasn't a linear story. It wasn't like you told the possibility story, well, like you were inspired. No, it wasn't that. I was on a committee that had that was looking at the use of computation in the university. It was a great committee. We wrote a report, and the report was sent to the dean, and it died, and nothing happened. So,
that was a trigger. It was rejected.
It was rejected, but then something, so I'm working with a colleague of mine, he's on innovation in engineering education. And he says, Dave, I'm going to go talk to the dean and we're going to do something about having more innovative engineers here at Illinois. I said, great. he goes and talks to the same dean that didn't do anything with the report, comes back, says, Dave, good news. The dean's going to form a committee and we're going to help him write the charge. And I got pissed off. I said, this was Andreas Kangalaris, who later became provost of Illinois and is now president of Neom University in Saudi Arabia. Anyway, he comes back and I said, well, I got pissed off. I said, I am not going to be on another committee spurred by this guy where nothing happens. Either we act and do something and make something happen, or let's forget about it and go back and write our research proposals and be good little research engineers, engineering professors like they expect us to. Well, so he was afraid that, you know, we weren't going to do anything. Anyways, I started to write a white paper. He chimed in, and we wrote a white paper about Illinois as not a committee, but as an action group. And we didn't ask for permission to do it. We just went and did it. And we took some of the people from engineering and technology studies that we were already meeting, and we started a class on transforming engineering education at Illinois, and we had like 18 students sign up for it, and then we sent them to other places that were doing interesting things. So it came from that refusal, but indirectly it was like I was so tired of being on these committees that didn't do anything, which is the usual thing that happens with committees. Let's actually take action, and so that led to iFoundry being unofficial. And then a few years later, and there were interesting stories there about how it happened, but a few years later, it became an official activity of the University of Illinois, and we were charged with working on the freshman experience to start.
Tell us a little bit more about iFoundry. Could you just, in a few sentences?
Yeah, iFoundry was about saying that we basically started from the premise that engineering education was kind of stuck in kind of a Cold War mode, and it was stuck in a mode of science uber alles as opposed to design or practice, and that practice is more than merely applying science in particular situations. So we started there. I had a deck that I walked around campus with called "The Times They Are Changing." I had a picture of Bob Dylan on it, and we're sending these messages. The first activity in iFoundry was this class, and then we persuaded the dean and the associate dean, who was actually of undergraduate stuff, who was really quite supportive that to make this an official activity, and we were charged with having some new activity in the freshman experience that would help make students more engaged with their education. But of course, they didn't give us any money. They gave us a little bit of money and they didn't give us any credit hours. So we came up with a one credit. It was a combination of experience and course. And the course was called "The Missing Basics of Engineering." And the class experience was a team experience where optionally people could do projects. They could work on getting to know the world of work. They could work on helping each other succeed. There were sort of four major goals inside of the initial, we called it the Illinois Engineering Freshman Experience. The cool thing was that even we also, and this was pivotal, we partnered with, in some ways, the most entrepreneurial new college that had been started in engineering in 20 years. We partnered with Olin College in Needham, Massachusetts. And part of that class that I talked about, we went and visited them. And one of the things that I noticed, I went with two graduate students and we observed their classes. And in one class, they were actually testing some heat sinks that they had built for this class on distributed modeling. And so they were testing these heat sinks. And so the professor said, go talk to these guys from Illinois. So they came and talked to us. And I talked to them and I realized that emotionally, these kids in their freshman year were already engineers. They already got it. You know, they understood how cool it was to do something technically that was that worked and was interesting and different. And I said, oh my gosh, if, you know, so we've been thinking about the rational side of this forever. And what are the courses and what's the teaching sequence and what homeworks problems do people need to do? But that was the first time I saw this kind of emotional component. And I said, man, if we could bottle that and bring that back to Illinois, that would be something. And it actually, I didn't know it at the time, but it actually gave us hope that this little pea shooter of a course that we created might actually do something. And that turned out to be the case. We did our little pea shooter, and even though we were only doing one credit, we got this unleashing of the students emotionally, and they grabbed on to being engineers and embraced their engineering identity in a way that we had no reason to expect in a one credit course. And I said, oh my gosh, that's the stuff. How do we stop boring these kids to death? How do we get them to grab onto what they want to do in their lives? And that was the theme of iFoundry, and was also the theme of really everything I've done since then. How do we get this engagement? How do we get intrinsic motivation into an educational system that's been designed to snuff it all out?
I'm Stephen Armstrong. You're listening to the Innovation Nation on Career Buzz here on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and worldwide online at CIUT.FM. David, it's hard to believe this, but we've only like 7 minutes to the break, or 6 minutes. So we've a lot to cover here.
Sure.
I actually would love to hear more about Olin College, but maybe you can weave it in. Let's talk about what you became quite famous for in your academic work that then had an impact later, which is the AI and sure. The genetic algorithms within AI, et cetera. Could you just tell us a little bit about that? Because that's what gave you prestige as an academic before you give it all up. So just give us a little bit on that.
Yeah, so genetic algorithms are computational procedures that are loosely based on natural selection, sort of survival of the fittest, and as well as natural genetics, things like mutation, recombination, and so forth. When people first hear it, they say, well, that's going to evolution has taken place over millions of years. Isn't that inherently slow? But it actually, when you look at it computationally, it's actually quite quick. And you can think of it as a way to solve any old kind of problem. You want to solve for example, General Electric used genetic algorithms to design the engines for Boeing 777, back when Boeing planes still were flying right.
That's another topic, but go ahead.
Let's not segue to that. But no. But the idea is you create a chromosome that represents many of the design alternatives. The different alternatives in the genes can represent millions or billions of possible design combinations. And then you create a population of randomly of these jet engines, and mama jet engine has mates with daddy jet engine and has baby jet engine. And then the question is it more or less efficient? And whatever, and you can have even multiple criteria in the mix. But and so then you evolve generation after generation, and these simulated jet engines get better and better and better. And you use those decisions. You can use it in scheduling. They've been used in scheduling. They've been used in drug design. They've been used in everything. And so, but the idea is simple, borrowed from natural, from biology. In fact, the major things that are driving generative AI today come kind of biologically. Deep learning uses analogs to the human brain and neural nets and so forth, deep learning. And genetic algorithms use analogs to survival of the fittest and recombination and mutation and so forth.
David, we're going to stop in that one. So let's talk about your book, your 2014 book, Well, two books. One was the 2014 book, A Whole New Engineer, The Coming Revolution in Engineering Education. And then the second follow-up book in 2023, A Whole New Engineer, called A Field Manual for a Whole New Education. In 3 minutes, put those in context. Look, we could have a whole radio show just on one book or one chapter of one book.
Absolutely.
So try to put all that in context in 2.5 minutes.
Yeah, so a whole new engineer contrasted David and Goliath, Olin College and the University of Illinois, and the commonality of the good stuff. So Olin started with a new curriculum, all new faculty. Illinois was legacy, but they both got the unleashing of students to embrace their inner engineer. So that was interesting that these two very different places could do that, and we analyzed that from both an emotional and a cultural point of view, also using ideas from change leadership and so forth. That was a whole new engineer. And that book was really a surprising success, sold. We got close to about 10,000 copies sold. It was, even though it was sold privately, it was really successful. And people were walking around campus with it. Deans were saying more of this here, which was really cool. The field manual tried to answer more practical questions. How do we do this at our school? And so we tried to give more of a how-to guide of what do you do first, second, and third in the field manual. And we came up with some ideas about 5 shifts that need to take place in terms of mindset, as well as 4 sprints and spirits that can get you from where you are now to a more engaging not just engineering education, but higher education generally.
2 things that I want to say before we go to the break. One is your AI academic career and your professional civil engineering career give you the credibility so that when you talked about this transformation, you had some strong foundation in which to stand. You had been a proven teacher and a proven researcher, and you had practiced civil engineering. So as a change agent, you had credibility. No one could undermine you. And in the second half, we're going to pick up that journey, that change management journey in the universities, which I'm going to assume were the most difficult institutions to actually change and to adopt change. So in the second half, we'll pick it up. And then I also want to talk about what you termed as the digital gaggle. And that's where all these new technologies are transforming higher education as well as society in general. So in the second half, we'll pick it up. My guest today is David Goldberg. I'm Stephen Armstrong. You're listening to the Innovation Nation on Career Buzz here on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and worldwide online at CIUT.FM. We're going to take a break and be right back with Professor David Goldberg, rebooting higher education in an AI-dominated world. And we're going to play a song, famous song from Nat King Cole, Straighten Up and Fly Right. And David is actually learning this in his jazz guitar class. So let's listen to Nat King Cole, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Buzzer took a monkey for a ride in the air. The monkey thought that everything was on the square. The buzzer tried to throw the monkey off of his back, but the monkey grabbed his neck and said, "Now listen, Jack. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top. Ain't no use in diving. What's the use of jiving? Straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top." The buzzer told the monkey, "You are choking me. Release your hold and I will set you free." The monkey looked the buzzer right dead in the eye and said, "Your story's so touching, but it sounds just like a lie. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and stay right. Straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top."
We're back at the Innovation Nation on Career Buzz. Buzz, and I'm your host, Stephen Armstrong. Just wanted to say that that previous song with Nat King Cole was also with Irving Mills, and it's from 1943, and it sounds just as good now as it did then. It was a top song. In fact, I think it launched his career. David will be able to tell us when I speak to him in a minute. Anyway, before continuing to our second part of our interview, I want listeners to know about the Innovation Nation Archive. Go to amgimanagement.com and select Radio Show. There are well over 130 previous shows on a wide range of topics: strategic thinking, design thinking, leadership and innovation, artificial intelligence, engineers and doctors without borders, and there's many other topics. So there's a whole, and David will be added to that within a few days. David, welcome back to the second part.
Good to be back.
Now, in the first part, like, again, there's just so much to cover here. You just give us a brief overview of your two books, one in 2014 and one in 2023, yep. A Whole New Engineer and a Field, like a guidebook. Now, our title was Rebooting Higher Education. Should I have said higher engineering education, or are you looking at all of higher education in all fields, humanities as well?
Well, so the first book, A Whole New Engineer, had the E word in the main title, and so we were focused on particular stories for engineering education, and it was a hit in engineering education circles. But we found that other people would come to our workshops and say, well, this applies everywhere. So, and we didn't disagree with them. We just didn't have experience with it. But since then we've worked with people in other schools. And the full title of the field manual is A Field Manual for a Whole New Education, Rebooting Higher Education for Human Connection and Insight in a Digital World. And so we expanded it, although in many ways the methods of A Whole New Engineer are now kind of applied generically.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we talk about the digital gaggle,
yep.
I want to talk about in 2010 when you give up your tenure, you give up a well-paying position, a high-status position, to go out on your own. Were you worried about finances, or maybe you were rich? I don't know, but like you give up a salary of here's this. I make an assumption. You had a big salary. You saved up a good bit of money from it, but you had a deep passion to make change happen. You weren't happy working in the system. You wanted to work on the system, on the higher education system. So you walked out of there. Were you nervous about money? Were you nervous about whether that it may not succeed? Or did you know you could fall back as a professor?
Well, it turned out that, floating down the Mississippi from one thing to the next, I actually turned, sometimes it's better to be lucky than skillful. And I worked 6 or 7 years at Alabama, and then I worked 20 years at Illinois. And Illinois, in the states, the pension systems aren't uniform. They differ from state to state and school to school. And so I was able to get credit for the time. I had to pay money for it, but I was able to get credit for the time that I spent in the Alabama system, in the Illinois system. So when I left the university, I had 27 years in, and they had, I was still in my 50s, but they had different ways of calculating your pension benefits. And a friend of mine, an engineering, really great engineer named Larry Bergman, says, "Hey, Dave, look at how they calculate this." And so I looked at how they calculated pensions, and it turned out I didn't get a full pension, but I got a pretty darn good pension for someone in their 50s. So
gotcha.
I was able to do it without making my wife nervous or me nervous. And and the other thing that happened was people really dug what we were doing. And so I was getting contacts in Brazil and Singapore. And so, for example, I got a 3-year gig part-time in Singapore to help
to
them.
To help
transform engineering education at the National University of Singapore.
On that note, do you think that universities outside the United States or outside the United States, Canada, like the English-speaking countries, do you think they're more open-minded about this?
Oh, more open-minded than whom? Than
that? Do you think that you went to Singapore? Do you think that non-English, like there's UK, USA, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, we'll call it the English-speaking world. Do you think that the like Latin America, Southeast Asia, etc., are more open to change in higher education and engineering and so on?
Yeah, you know, that's hard to say. I would say this, that a lot of those countries look to the states or to the Commonwealth for examples. When we were doing iFoundry, we were getting visitors from these different places to say, oh, this iFoundry, tell us about it. And they'd come and visit. I think some of the effect that was going on was that kind of natural looking by these other places to what they considered best practices. I would say that a lot of my business has been outside the U.S., so, although I've done business in Canada and in Ireland and in Europe. So it just depends. I think it's really more about the kind of faculty or leaders and what they're interested in accomplishing and whether they sometimes people want to do it themselves, but they underestimate how difficult it is. You alluded to this at the end of the last segment, how difficult it is to change something as hidebound as higher education is.
And that's where your coaching skills come into play. But before that, let's talk about Digital Gaggle. What is it in a nutshell?
Yeah, so the Digital Gaggle is kind of a shorthand I developed in a field manual to talk about robotics, machine learning, AI, pervasive apps, and the ways in which those have become, they become closer to us. You know, back when I was doing computation in college, we used punch cards or paper tape. But, you know, now we have these little devices that we carry around with us 24/7. Mm-hmm. And so they get closer to us. They interrupt us more and they're interconnected to us more. And so that there's this whole, the digital gaggle and its rise. And in addition, it's becoming more competent. As we're seeing with generative AI and the increased competence and the number of different things that these systems can do. And so I was really interested in what does that mean? And first, what does it mean sort of philosophically for education? And are there things that the digital gaggle does well and will get much, much better than we are? And are there things that the digital gaggle isn't really very good at yet that people are still superior at? And that was sort of the pivotal question to me is, what are the things that the digital gaggle is not good at? And what does that mean for how we should change education?
Hey, talk about generative AI, which is part of the digital gaggle, what you've termed the digital gaggle. What's generative AI going to do to higher education? I mean, we know that the journalists and writers in Hollywood and all kinds of industries are being disrupted. How could this disrupt higher education in a nutshell?
Yeah, it's hard. So, and I'm not really a. There are lots of people that pretend that they're swamis or gurus and predictors of the future. I'm not that, but I actually like to look back to look forward. And so, I was asked to write an article for Professional Engineers Magazine a while back, and I started to think, well, what in my lifetime, what transformative technology has come in and what did it do and how quickly did that take place, recognizing that things are moving faster now? And so I thought about, you know, starting school in the 70s with a slide rule and the coming of the HP 35 to do computations. And I, back in the 70s, I was in a surveying course, and we had to reduce our surveying calculations with accurate surveying calculations with 8 digits of sines and cosines, and we had to use a big table of sines and cosines put out by the Geodetic Survey to do that. But then the HB35 comes along and gives you 12 significant digits of sines and cosines at the push of a button. And so I thought about, well, what, you know, and the analogy, both like all analogies, it holds in some ways and it fails in others. And so so quickly, an effective technology kind of seeps its way into what we do pretty quickly. And it's really hard to stop, and even if you want to. And that happened with the digital calculator versus the slide rule. But then there are the things that we lose in the coming. So for example, when you use the slide rule, you really had a good sense of number. You understood that most engineering calculations were only good to 2 or 3 digits. You understood about orders of magnitude, because you had to do the exponents by hand. You had to add and subtract the powers of 10 by hand. So you really had a good sense of number. Well, that was lost. You know, and so now kids, I remember as a professor, even 10 years ago, kids would come to class with ridiculous numbers that made absolutely no sense, because they didn't have a sense of number. It wasn't part of their experience. I think that now, and so that sense of number was what we lost with a calculator. So
I have to say this.
Go ahead.
I started my engineering education literally when the slide rule was replaced. That's no joke. I bought the slide rule and never used it. It changed. It literally, things changed. I was through that in those 2 years. There was a period where it became, they made us buy it. But then I think we had to use the calculators. So I can remember that. And so I never mastered the slide rule. But what I always was told by older engineers was it made you think from first principles. So it was more.
I think that analogy is really helpful for us, because this generative AI is coming like a freight train. It will, the things that it's good at, it's going to take over. It's already taking over.
Yes.
And there are already articles about the ways that it's taking over. Now, I'm not at the university. I don't see it firsthand, but I talk to clients and they tell me it's happening. But the losses can be significant. So the loss of a sense of number, or loss of that sense of first principles, we're talking about generative AI that's trained on anything that is written down, or anything that's articulated. So I like to think of it this way, is kind of theory versus practice.
I wanted to get you into that, David. No, theory and practice. Go ahead.
Yeah. No. So anything that's kind of got that's theoretical, and generative AI is going to kick tail. It's going to work like a top. It already is working like a top. And so there is the sense that our young engineers will lose that. Is I'm not sure it's important to maintain that sense of the theory and where these things come from. But it also opens up possibilities for engineers doing things that they don't currently do. And so, you know, what does it mean to be practice? And for this, I really am a fan of Don Shun's 1983 book. You know, I once did a speaking gig, and all my, you know, I was quoting Aristotle and 1983 references, and they fired me because I didn't have current references. But anyways, but a good reference is a good reference is a good reference. So anyway, Don Shun wrote this wonderful book called The Reflective Practitioner, and he made a distinction between theory and practice, and there's a couple ways to come at this. So Yogi Berra, the Yankees catcher and manager, is said to have said, there in theory there's no difference between theory and practice, in practice there is, which is a wonderful saying. He didn't really say it, but Yogi also said, I didn't say everything I said. So that covers that situation. But the sense of the idea that we teach engineering right now is that we teach theory and that practice is merely the application of theory in particular situations.
And yeah, I have a hard time without one because as a person, it's practice is all my whole life. Like, I mean, yeah, go ahead. I mean, it's
no,
crazy.
No. And Don Shun said that's wrong. He said, look, he said that idea, let's call it, he gave it a name. He called it technical rationality. And he said that that misunderstands practice deeply. He said that practice is essentially a reflective interaction with the situation, with other practitioners, with the client. And he called it reflection in action. And I think he was getting at it's hard to get at what practice is really, but I think he was starting to get at it. I like, from my coaching background, so much of good practice is in conversation. So I call it conversation in action. But if you want to teach young engineers how to be good practitioners, we need to teach them to be better in conversation. They need to teach them to be better listeners. We need to teach them to be better question askers. We need to teach them to be better noticers of what's going on right now. And those things are the essence of practice. And I would argue that generative AI is going to be great at technical rationality, and it's going to be crappy at reflection in action and conversation in action.
I'm Stephen Armstrong, and you're listening to the Innovation Nation on Career Buzz here on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and worldwide online at CIUT.FM. You had other things that you had. You had a concept called the five shifts, and four of them were theory. One was theory, one was practice, and the other, well, I'll just say them. One was the head and the heart. Tell us a little bit about the head and the heart as far as reflective practice is concerned.
Well, so, and this goes back to the iFoundry experience we talked about in the first session, that we found out that it was that the essence of change was essentially emotional and cultural. And we think of it as being rational. Let's come up with the change plan. But then you come up with a change plan and nothing happens. Well, it's because there's emotional resistance or cultural resistance to the change plan. So you better understand both the motivation of the people that you're working with, as well as the underpinnings of the culture that you're working with. So that shift is, okay, let's be rational. Yes, let's have plans, but we also need to pay attention to the head and the heart. And as a coach, oftentimes someone will be stuck and I'll ask them questions. I'll ask them emotional questions, or I'll ask them even questions about body feelings. I'll say, where in the body are you feeling that emotion? And all of a sudden we have a different conversation. So it's about us as human beings, fully formed human beings, not just brains on a stick. And so it's that shift from treating education as merely passing on the rational stuff. Generative AI is going to be really good at it. Maybe we should spend marginally more time on the cultural and emotional side.
Gotcha. Now, you coined this concept, this term, co-contraries.
Yep.
And you were saying theory and practice are co-contraries, and there are others. Just expand on that a little bit, please.
Well, and I know your interest in philosophy, and I talked about my interest in philosophy, but, so if you go back to Aristotle and the golden mean, he had these opposites, and he talked about needing to balance them foolhardy, being foolhardy and timid is kind of bravery. Well, there are lots of things that appear to be opposites, but we need both of them.
Yes.
And so there's a guy named Barry Johnson, who I've worked with, who's a really good thinker and a good practitioner. And he uses the term polarity. I learned my first experience with the co-contraries with the writing instructor, Peter Elbow. He uses the term contrary, but I actually think the term co-contrary is a better term. So for example, this is a Barry Johnson example. Which is better, inhaling or exhaling? Well, you kind of need both to life. So that there are contraries, inhaling and exhaling. You need to do both in sequence to get things right. But you can, the same idea applies in lots of stuff. Which is better, great individual work or great teamwork? Well, great organizations are built with both. So how do we have and excellence? How do I have great individual work and great teamwork in an organization? Which is better? Sometimes people, when I say, I talk about other things, I talk about practice and I diminish theory. Some of my colleagues in the university say, well, won't that dilute the basics, by which they mean the theoretical basics? And no, I want engineers that have good theoretical basics, and I want them to be great practitioners. So I want good theory and good practice. That's the idea of a co-contrary. And there's some, it's actually in change leadership, I found that it's really helpful because the resistance to change often comes from the contrary that is currently dominant in the organization. So if you kind of start from the currently dominant contrary and say, we value this, but oftentimes change leaders are interested in talking about the new stuff, but actually it's better to start with the stuff that you're already good at. And then talk about, actually what you talk about is you talk about the ways in which doing too much of the good stuff is getting you some bad results. And so you can create a little four quad chart that pictures the ways in which the too much of a good thing is giving you bad stuff. Then you could talk about, well, so for example, too much theory gives us engineers that aren't very good at practice. Adequate practice gets us engineers that can go out in the world and get a job. Too much practice gets us engineers that don't understand first principles.
Absolutely.
So how do we get this and excellence as we're trying to make change in a system? That's the fundamental idea of a co-contrary. Let's not try to solve it once and
I got you. So you're looking for balance.
That actually opens up another can of worms that we may or may not have.
Before David, I have to take 6 minutes. We have 6 minutes to go. And in those 6 minutes, we're going to talk about the how of rebooting higher education.
Yeah.
You took proven change. Now, you again, remember, 6 minutes, we got to do it. You took proven change management methodologies and methods from industry into academia. Tell us about that, please.
Well, so, the first part of it was just taking the practical stuff that I learned in iFoundry. And then I left, and actually you asked me earlier about my decision to leave the university. I hired an executive coach to help me figure out what I wanted to do with my career. I thought I wanted to be a dean, but after talking to this really great coach, her name's Bev Jones, I still work with her. I realized that the stuff I was doing in iFoundry was more interesting than anything I would do as a dean or even higher up in the university. So I decided to go out on my own, and in part through this coaching experience on it. And I said, where'd you learn to do this? She asked such great questions. I said, I need to learn how to ask those great questions and to listen like you're listening to me. So I took training at Georgetown as an executive coach, and the fundamentals of coaching, helped make me better as a facilitator. It helped me with one-on-one coaching of change leaders. So that whole skill set of listening, understanding the role of speech acts, understanding how requests and commitments make teams work, and it was transformative in a really cool way.
So you actually learned that it wasn't instinctively within you. Is that correct?
My head exploded when I went to a coaching class. The stories are in some ways more interesting than the content. But that first day of class, I go to school and I'm there with 35 other coaches, and they ask us after a check-in, what do you notice? And I got ticked off. I said, what do you mean what I notice? I just spent five figures to come here. I want to learn some real coaching skills. But of course, noticing and awareness is the fundamental coaching skill that you have to learn to be able to help someone. So yes, it wasn't instinctive. I wasn't awful at it. I advised students, and I don't think I did them harm, but I became the coaching skill set was important.
You have another label as part of your management of change approach, and you call it the four sprints and spirits method. You're good at labeling things, I've noticed, and it's good because you conceptualize a system or a method in order to explain it simply. What is your four sprints and spirits method?
Well, the four sprints and spirits borrows from agile development practices, where you do a series of sprints to get to where you want to go. And so the first sprint is called the four spirits sprint. So a key problem in making change in a university is that everyone thinks they're the smartest guy in the room. And so let's change the curriculum. So the arguments are usually no more mature than, well, the curriculum I took when I went to University of Toronto or MIT is better than the curriculum you took at some funky state school. And so it's sort of ego-based arm wrestling.
Of course, status.
And so how do you overcome that? So the four spirits, we teach them about modern motivation theory. We teach them about, we use Edstein's theories of culture. We teach them about co-contraries. And then we also use a little design thinking to have them think about the personae of the students they're designing for. In 10 years, where will you draw your students from, and what will they be? What will they become? So that we're now thinking of, we have a common basis to think about how we should change education. So we start from that place. We have them look at good exemplars in the next sprint. Then we have them create a canvas of possibilities in the third sprint. And then we have them use principled negotiation in the fourth sprint to kind of come to a plan. In a nutshell, that's what it's about. But it takes some time, and it takes a devoted design team to get through all those steps.
But it's a systematic approach. Okay, 1 minute. Tell me, you talk about effective AFFECTIVE implementation, and I always think of effective implementation. Yep. What is effective implementation? What's that mean?
Well, so we've all been to a workshop where you had a great workshop, a lot of learning. In fact, there's a different spirit in the room, and then you go back home and none of it transfers. So the problem is that experiences like culture are affective. So how do we, when we have a good experience, when you have a wonderful change, I've had change initiatives that were terrific, how do we get the spirit of that to carry forward during the implementation process? And the problem is we usually just think about the plan. We don't think about the affect or the emotion and culture. So how do we create a little place, a little incubator, or I call it an RSSI, a respectful structured space for innovation, where we can capture the spirit that was created during that time and carry that on as we do the implementation. That's the essence of effective implementation.
Gotcha. It reminds me of the concept of winning the hearts and minds and actually transforming them from within to take action.
Yep.
We're finished. We'll have a part two and we'll think about what we should really drill into. This has been a broad sweep of multiple careers, but thank you so much, David. It's been great.
Stephen, that's, like I said, it's great to finally be on with you, and I really enjoyed our time together.
Okay. You've been listening to Innovation Nation on Career Buzz. Ken's unique radio conversation empowers lives, enriches careers, and energizes organizations here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Stephen Armstrong. If you have any comments on today's show or questions, email me at samstrong@amgimanagement.com, and I'll also give you the contact information for Professor David Goldberg, who just gave us a great overview of rebooting higher education in an AI-dominated world. A copy of this show will be available on CIUT.FM's website in within 2 days of airing, and it'll be on my website permanently. Thank you for tuning in this morning.